guys. Welcome to Wicked, Weird, and Grim, your number one podcast for a trip through the history of the odd, haunting, and mystifying. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Aura. Together, we're the Grimm sisters.
Today is a super special episode because...
we've got a guest! Hi, Shutoma.
Hi, I've never done this before. This is exciting.
We're so happy to have you.
Yeah, thank you for taking time out. Shutoma is my course mate in our anthropology PhD program at Oxford, and she's also a fan of the spooky. We actually, like, one of the first things we did, like, outside of class socially was we made it a priority to go on a ghost tour this October, though it was kind of a little bit disappointing. I feel like we could have done better, but she also just, you know, generally entertains my weirdness, so...
I enjoy it. It's fun. I don't mind.
Thankfully, we get paid for it.
So with that, we're going to get into the narrative part of the podcast. Shutoma, take it away.
Okay, so one of the reasons that Aura and I got talking in the first place was the fact that the part of India I come from, West Bengal, has a really rich history of stories and ritual practices involving the supernatural, ghosts, paranormal, spooky things, spooky sounds, you name it, right? So I'm Bengali, and I grew up with stories of all kinds of ghosts. So we had water ghosts, ghosts that live in trees, ghosts that steal your fish, ghosts of married women, ghosts of unmarried women. And from my perspective growing up, this was an unproblematic part of everyday life. There was nothing untoward about it. But then I moved to Delhi, and that was a whole different cultural crowd. And I realized how much of an anomaly this conversation around supernatural is. So what happened was, when I moved to Delhi, immediately a lot of people were avoiding me and a lot of my Bengali friends. And the reason I learned later, when some of them did become my friends, was that this one girl said, you know, my mom had told me not to talk to Bengali girls too much because Bengali women are witches. And they sort of curse you or manipulate you into doing things that you don't want to do. And I that was the first time I had been accused of being a witch.
But not the last.
And I...
it's wild. Yeah,
but the thing is, I realized that this wasn't a one-off thing, because Bengali women being witches, and not just Bengali women, women from the eastern and northeastern part of India being witches is apparently a very common trope from Indians in North India and Central India. So I remember when, so there was a very famous actor in India called Sushant Singh Rajput, who passed away by suicide in 2020, right? And he had a Bengali girlfriend called Riya Chakraborty. So the moment he passed away, all the news channels were filled with, is Riya a witch? Oh, wow. Did she curse him? Did she suck his lifeblood away? And all the neighbors where they lived, all the neighbors claimed that they had seen Riya, her irises changing color or strange sounds coming. It was really, really odd. So yeah, Bengali women being witches apparently is a very popular misconception in what I call the Hindi-speaking belt of India, which is basically northern and central India. I should mention that part of India, North India, kind of dominates the rest of India linguistically, religiously, politically, culturally, every which way. So yeah, this was us being outcast. Anyway, so since that incident and since several other accusations of being a witch, I sort of got interested in the history of the supernatural in Bengal and why we talk about ghosts so much and why it's normal, whereas it's not in other parts of India. And I started studying, talking to people. Mind you, I am a Hindu Bengali, so my findings are largely relevant to Hindu Bengali experiences. Although other religions in Bengal, mostly Christianity and Islam, they do have their own narrative cultures that relate to the supernatural, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So, okay, this is going to get a little anthropological, historical, so bear with me. So in Hinduism, there are several different denominations, right? One of the main denominations, which Bengalis follow mostly, is Shaktism, right? And Shaktism believes that the main god is a woman or a female entity called Shakti. And Shakti itself means strength and energy and power, right? So there are other goddesses in Shaktism, like Parvati, who is benevolent, she protects, she mothers, she nourishes. There's Durga, the fierce one, who fights and defeats evil. And there's Kali, the goddess of power, destruction, and death. Also, Shaktism endorses meat eating, right? Now, this sounds a little random, but it's important because, as we're going to see in a lot of other denominations, things like meat, alcohol, these are really frowned upon. And so that's just one other reason that Shaktism is sort of frowned upon as a whole by a lot of people in North and Central India. So that's Shaktism. On the other hand, the Hindi-speaking belt in India, North India, they follow a different strand of Hinduism called Vaishnavism, mostly, right? So Vaishnav Hindus worship Vishnu, who's a male god. He protects, he maintains, and he transforms the universe. So there are two other gods, Brahma and Shiva, right? So Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, they form this sort of our version of the Holy Trinity, where Brahma creates the universe, Vishnu maintains it, and Shiva destroys it, right? So there's this sort of cyclical maintenance of the universe. The most important difference between these two denominations, that's Shaktism and Vaishnavism, is their paths to salvation. So Vaishnavism privileges a householder life, where you go to school, you get married, you have a family, and then towards the end of your life, you begin to slowly renunciate worldly goods for a monastic life. So very like vanilla. And then there's Shaktism, which are very closely related to tantric practices. So tantra and I've realized that tantra and tantric practices have a very different connotation in the West, which I'm gonna get to. So tantra refers to a set of yogic practices common to Hinduism and Buddhism, which for some reason is associated mostly with sex in the West, mostly in America.
Sorry about that.
But it's okay. I forgive you. So what tantric practitioners do is that they use mantras, meditation, yoga, and ritual uses of mandala diagrams to activate energy flows within the body and the mind, open up what they say is the microcosmic universe that each of us has within ourselves, and then connect that microcosm within you to the wider universe. And so you achieve your full potential, right? Shaktism also includes, quote, the non-dualistic and transgressive or left-hand traditions like the Kali cults and the Trika school, end quote. Rituals and prayer ceremonies can include certain left-hand path elements that are not found in more orthodox traditions. These include the use of skulls and other human-born implements, fierce deities like Bhairava, who are used as part of meditative visualizations, ritual possession by deities, sexual rites, and offering the deity and consuming certain impure substances like alcohol, sexual fluids, and of course meat, which upper caste Vaishnavs are averse to, right? So basically, not vanilla, fruity. So it's sort of like,
best description.
Yeah, fruity. We're fruity. So this is where things get even more juicy. Due to this association of tantric traditions with magical practices, sexuality, and violent rituals, the tantric traditions have, over the past few centuries, been associated with black magic in India. The term tantra is now best known in South Asia in the compound Tantra Mantra, which is the equivalent of, you know, when we say in English hocus pocus or abracadabra, basically something that someone does to trick you or manipulate you or fool you, something that's very deceitful. And Tantra is also used nowadays in a lot of Bollywood films to invoke ideas of black magic, of evil, of immorality, of illicit sexuality, you know, the whole shebang. So this very poor caricaturized understanding of Shaktism, coupled with the centrality that it gives to female mystical power, somehow translates into the idea that women from Eastern and Northeastern India are witches. This preconception has consequences, of course. I mean, the most sort of innocuous consequence, for want of a better word, is I remember when I was in Delhi, a lot of my single Bengali female friends were denied accommodation by a lot of landlords on the suspicion that, okay, you're a single Bengali woman, you're going to entice my son into something. And then, you know, you're going to steal him from us. So that's innocuous. At the other extreme end, there are people, especially in Northeast India, every year I think some 100 or 200 women are killed on grounds of being accused of being a witch and practicing witchcraft. So Vice News reported, quote, "Accusing someone of practicing witchcraft is an easy scapegoat in property disputes or conflict over material wealth within the family," end quote. So basically, the moment there's a little kerfuffle in the family about who's going to inherit what, accuse the daughter-in-law of being a witch, get rid of her, and then you get her portion of the property as well. And it's very common.
That's horrible.
On the other hand, Shakta beliefs and practices also mean that we Bengalis are far more comfortable discussing the supernatural than some of our northern Indian counterparts. So ghosts have been an integral part of our culture and literature. I remember I was told ghost stories almost every single night by my grandmom and by my mother before going to bed. And I was never scared.
The best time to be told
ghost stories. The best time to be told ghost stories. And that's,
you know, the only good time, really.
So what I did is I drew up a list of some of the ghosts we have in Bengali culture. So let's just, you know, go through it. The first one is a Shakchunni. This is the spirit of a married woman who wears a special kind of traditional bangle made of shells called Shakha in Bengal around their arms, and they keep kind of jangling it, and that's a sign of the married Hindu woman in Bengal.
I think I've heard about this before, an association with clacking bangles, and that's what like precipitates seeing them, I think.
Yeah. You hear bangles clacking, you run.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You run. You just straight up run.
You run. Sometimes they can also wear anklets, but that varies regionally. It's in Bengal, it's the bangles. Then we have Petnis, who are female ghosts who died with unsatisfied desires or who were unmarried.
She's like me.
I was literally just thinking that's going to be me someday.
Well, it's also like, it's no wonder that some of these like female figures appear as ghosts when, you know, their family members are accusing them of being witches. Like, I would haunt the shit out of people too. Like, whatever.
I love that. I love that. Then there's the Damori. So Damori refers to supernatural entities conjured by tantrics, basically practitioners of tantra. So in tantric philosophy, if someone were to engage in ascetic pursuit and worship and they invoked Damori, the Damori would appear to them and serve them. So basically, Damoris are not human or ghosts. They sort of exist in an in-between realm. And if invoked properly, they can assist you. If invoked properly. If.
Yeah. It sounds like they're not often invoked properly.
Yeah, seems like a lot of problems arise from that one.
To me, when I heard Damori, I thought it sounded like the Latin word daemon, which means spirit, but now in Western connotation means demon. But it also distinctly reminded me of how witches have like familiars that help them enact their plans, and like they're not entirely in our world, they're kind of in the netherworld. But yeah, it was really interesting how it overlaps.
I don't know if the root of the two words, demon and Damori, is the same, but it's something worth exploring. Then you have Beshobhut. So Besho comes from the word bash, which means bamboo. So basically, Besho Bhoot are ghosts that live in bamboo gardens. And a popular superstition is that if a bamboo plant is leaning or laying on the ground, no one should cross over it and should instead go around it, because people are scared that the bamboo would rise up unexpectedly by the spirit and then the person would be impaled by it and then they would just die. So
that sounds like something that would happen to Aura.
And yeah, you'd still survive.
Yeah, I would.
You do have a track record for surviving very unfortunate things.
Like wild things.
I know, right? One day we need to talk about all the times I've almost died and the time I did die.
Yeah.
What's that movie with Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn? Death Becomes Her, is it?
I think so. Yeah,
where they just can't die.
What you're talking about.
And they like suck the life out of children or something. I've always joked that's me. And I think we even learn about, or like a woman figure, a hag figure later on in the episode. And I'm like, yeah, that's me sucking the life out of children for, you know, survival.
Yeah. Then there's Pancha Pechi. So Pancha means an owl. And basically, these are ghosts in the form of owls that they basically lead helpless travelers through the woods until they're completely alone. And then they strike and kill their victims. Oh, no. And they also consume their victims in a vampiric way. Use your imagination. What does that suggest?
Are you sucking the soul out or the blood?
The blood.
Okay.
The question I have is, are they Dementors?
No, they're cute owls.
They're cute owls.
That makes it worth it.
So they're like Hedwig, if Hedwig were Dementors.
Yeah! Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. A really interesting thing, though, is that owls are seen as like a harbinger of death or a bad omen in like tons of cultures. And there's actually a cryptid somewhere in the UK that is this like owl creature, like an owl man or something like that.
Yeah, and Striga in Slavic mythology are like half owl, half woman, weird vampire ladies.
I want to be here.
They're having fun, though. I love them.
I want to be here.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Then there's Oily, which is basically they're sort of below the wisp kind of things, and they lead you into a river or a lake, and then you drown. So a lot of ghosts and supernatural entities use drowning as a strategy. They just distract you into wading your way into a water body, and then you drown.
So this is sounding very Scottish.
Could be.
Everything in Scotland drowns you, I swear.
I did read somewhere that when British colonialism took root in India, a lot of British concepts percolated into ghost stories. So it changed the way we think about ghosts. I can't remember who wrote it.
That makes sense, though.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Then you have Mecho Bhoot. These are the ones, so March means fish in Bengali. These ghosts are basically the ones that steal fish, because this is kind of stereotypical, but then what part of, you know, this isn't, a lot of this isn't, is Bengalis really love fish. We're fish people. So the thing is, even after death, you want fish and you try to steal them from people on their home, on the way home from the market. And then if they don't give it to you, you harm them.
Oh,
as a ghost. Then you have Mamdo Bhoot. So these are the ghosts of Muslims. And according to folklore, they choose to kill people by twisting their necks.
I'm going to have to tell my friend who her family is Bengali and Muslim. I'm going to have to tell her that that's what's going to happen when she dies. She's going to be a Mamdo Bhoot.
That's intense. That's real intense.
Then you have Gecho Bhoot. Gach means tree. So then basically these are ghosts that live in trees. Sometimes they're nice, they just hang about. Sometimes they can drop down on you while you're walking under the tree. So if you're walking under a tree at night, especially like a banyan tree, and you suddenly feel a heaviness on your shoulders, it means a ghost has dropped down on you.
That's really cool. I like that one.
That's terrifying, actually. So these reminded me of Chorales, but are they similar or are they different? Like, they're not considered witches, or...
No, so these are just ghosts. Chudails are basically witches, and the Hindi word for a witch is chudail. The Bengali equivalent of that would be daini. So dainis are witches. Yeah.
Oh, also, if you want to learn more about chudails, I highly recommend the movie Bulbul. Is that how you say it?
Bulbul.
Bulbul. And Shitoma recommended it to me after I asked her about chorels because I was really interested. And it was so good. It was so good. I highly recommend it. A lot of like female power and like justice and reclaiming of power. But
also just a visual treat.
It was really beautifully done. Yeah.
Interesting.
But slight trigger warning for SA, but it's really well done. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Then we have Begho Bhoot. Basically, Begho comes from the word Bagh, which means tiger. So basically, Begho Bhoot are ghosts of people who were killed or eaten by tigers in the Sundarbans, which is sort of like a delta area, south of West Bengal. Then there's Kondhokata. Oh, these are my favorite. The headless spirits, which are said to have come from people who were beheaded in a train accident or some other way.
Oh my god.
So, yeah, that's them. Then there's Kanabhulo. Kanabhulo are ghosts which hypnotize their targets and abduct them to a silent location, which causes the victim to slowly lose their senses. These type of ghosts mostly strike at night. So, lone travelers, a person that's separated from their group, are basically easy targets. Then there's Prapti. The word Prapti basically means to get something. In Bengali, Hindi, and Sanskrit too, I think. So these are spirits of women who had multiple lovers and suffered from indecision to the point of suicide in order to free themselves from the conflict.
I don't think that's ever happened, ever. Yeah,
But this is the kind of, it gets more complicated. The myth states that after they die, their lovers must also commit suicide in order to reunite with them. Or the Prapti will haunt them and drive them to insanity until they give in. So the Prapti's main purpose is revenge and not actual reunion with the lovers. So yeah, they do want their lovers to die, but not to really get with them, just to kind of... Which is, I mean, it would be kind of awkward. I don't know if you've seen that meme. It's like there's a ghost and then it scares a man and then the man dies and then the man ghosts sort of... emerges from his body and the two ghosts are looking at each other and they're like, this is awkward. So it's sort of like, what do you do with that?
Also imagine just like your lover from death comes to ask you to join them and you commit suicide and then once you do, she's just like, eh, and just like turns away. Like what?
Once they actually committed suicide, she was like, they're too clingy, I can't deal with this.
She was like, no, I was just seeing if you would do it.
Yeah, just testing you.
Their 13th reason why.
Okay, this is the one that Ara wanted to know. So Daini is a witch. It means witch. It's not an apparition, unlike a lot of the other bhoots that we talked about. But it's a living being. And they live in a lot of villages in Bengal and in northeastern states like Assam, Tripura. And the title is given to older women who are accused of practicing black magic. Okay, so here's the thing. Most of these women are A, older, and B, unmarried or widowed, right? So I'm just pointing out, the moment a woman steps out of the marriage fold, there's something wrong with her. She can no longer be trusted, yep. Right? So Dainis are believed to kidnap children, kill them, and feast on their blood to survive a century. Similar to the idea of a hag, similar to Hansel and Gretel, Hocus Pocus, the whole, you know.
Yeah.
And I have in the script written down very distinctly, God, I wish that were me. Dream job.
Then there's Brahmo Doito. So these are, I have mixed feelings about this one. So Brahmo Doito, the word comes from Brahmin, which is, Brahmins are sort of... the highest ranking people in the Hindu caste fold, right? They're at the top of the hierarchy and they oppress everyone below them. They're horrible. They have been for centuries. They continue to be. But most of folklore in Bengal would tell you that when Brahmins, they die and they become Brahmo Doitos, they are very benevolent and they help you, which I think is...
bullshit.
Yeah, it is BS. It is complete BS because they can't suddenly become good. They're bad.
Maybe death humbled them.
No, I don't think so.
I agree.
I don't know.
I agree.
Imagine elitist capitalists and horrible people just dying, and then in death they just suddenly become actual saints.
Like super nice. Or maybe it's one of the things, maybe it's like they die and when they in their death then they're kind of like enslaved to be to like pay for their bad ways in life, and so they're forced to be helpful.
Could be.
Yeah. And so that's why
that's an interesting nuance. Yeah. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Then you have Boba, not the kind of...
I love Boba.
Yeah, I
don't love Boba.
So Boba means someone who can't speak. And the Boba attacks its victims by strangling them when they sleep on their back. See, now that you've said Boba, I keep thinking of like just Boba, like a glass of Boba. Just
well... They can't speak because they drank boba and all the boba got stuck in their throat. So
oh no, that's like a horrifying.
That's cute. So basically what they do is they attack victims by strangling them when they sleep on their back. And then you just can't get up. So it's basically sleep paralysis, right? This is a sort of supernatural explanation for sleep paralysis. And when you do get sleep paralysis, in Bengali, they say bobe dhora, which is like the boba has sort of, it has you in its grip. And that's why you can't move. Then there is shikol buri or jol pishach.
Yay!
So these... female entities, they live in rivers, ponds, lakes, basically any water body, and they appear as young women with long wet hair and eyes with no irises, who had either committed suicide by drowning due to an unhappy marriage or violently drowned, especially after becoming pregnant with unwanted children. They're known to lure young men into nearby bodies of water where they entangle them with their hair and drown them. Sometimes they seduce their targets, forming a romantic relationship, in which case they can ask for a promise. And if the promise is broken, then they reveal their true form and kill the target.
I love them so much.
I love them. Yes,
they're literally just Rusalki in Slavic folklore. And you always gotta love a water spirit / mermaid /
mermaid!
You know, badass yep. girl who gets revenge on people who wronged her.
Yeah.
Especially with like just long, beautiful hair. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If I'm going to be one of these ghosts, I want to be her. She's amazing.
I believe in you, Caroline. You have the hair.
I do. Exactly. I have mermaid hair.
Mm-hmm.
I also love how patriarchy sort of the male ego extends to after death and the supernatural as well. Because even after death, men think it's all about them.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is about their wives and mistresses and lovers wanting to kill them after they die. It's amazing how much.
It's like they secretly know. It's like they secretly know. Yeah.
Yeah. And I literally have a poster on the left on my wall right now of Rusalki seducing a man into the water.
I love that. Where did you get it?
I don't know. I have a bunch of really like dramatic artwork that depicts mermaids killing men.
That's amazing.
It sets my soul alight, and I can't be any happier than when I look at it.
This is my friends.
It is my niche.
That's your genre.
Mm-hmm. That's my brand.
Yeah.
It is.
Then you have Nishi. So basically, they have really sweet sounding voices. And they lure their victims into secluded areas by calling to them with the voice of a loved one. And they strike only at night and only if the victim responds to their call, in which case it becomes hypnotized and is forced to follow the voice until it disappears. So, again, to sort of relate to medical terminology, sleepwalking is often explained with reference to Nishi. So it's also interesting how a lot of medical phenomena which didn't have sort of physiological explanations were sort of explained using ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just really interesting.
It happens globally. Like before everyone knew what psychology was, it was the Nishi, or it was the will-o-wisp, or it was the sirens, or, you know.
Then you have Rakkhush, basically monsters. Then you have Kokkosh, which are smaller monsters.
They're so cute.
Yeah, they just Kokkosh. They're like minions. Just
they're like imps. Oh. Little imps.
They wear overalls and they follow the main dude.
Oh, you mean real minion, like the minions from. I was thinking minions from like just like evil minions, but you meant
battle minions.
Banana. Banana. Then you have Doito. They look like human, but they're basically gigantic.
Oh.
Then you have Pishach, which is sort of closer to imps, I think.
Okay.
Imps or gargoyles?
Okay, so they look more disgusting.
Pishaches, they eat flesh. I don't know if gargoyles or imps do that. Do they?
I don't know.
So the term is so various. Like, it depends on how you use it. Like, to some, it's just beings who are look somewhat deformed and or like have like malicious or like demonic faces. But I don't necessarily think they are prescribed as eating flesh, but definitely they could. I wouldn't put it past them. I don't know what else they would eat, like getting a smoothie from Erewhon's or something. I don't know.
The next one is Betal or Vetal. So Betals are basically spirits that inhabit corpses. And once a corpse becomes possessed by a Betal, it no longer rots. So there's this really famous story in India, sort of a series of stories called Vikram and Vetal, or Bikram and Betal, if you're in Bengal, which basically a king, I don't remember it very well, where there's a king called Vikram, and he has to go to a tree, and there's a corpse in the tree, and he has to bring it back. But the Vetal in that tree keeps inhabiting the corpse. And just sort of, I think he tells the king stories in the form of riddles and the king has to solve them. But I can't remember exactly if he fails to solve the riddles or he solves it too late. Because so the Vetal keeps escaping. He just takes the corpse and keeps going back to the tree. So the king has to keep going back to the tree and bringing him back. So that's a whole thing. Then there's a Jokho, which are basically warrior-like entities who guard treasures within the earth. So there's a common Bengali idiom called Jokher Dhon, which Dhon means wealth. So it basically means wealth that's being guarded by a Jokho. So it's just an idiom we use a lot. Okay, this is like one of my, I wouldn't say favorite ones, but it's sort of the ones I discovered towards the end, and it's... I've read about this a lot in fiction and in nonfiction. They're called jinns, right? So jinns are jinns are more popular. They're more popular among Muslim communities in India. And the jinn is blamed for any supernatural, ghostly, and demonic phenomenon and manifestations. They can be benevolent or malevolent. So there's a very famous book called City of Jinns, right? And it's basically sort of a history of Delhi, right? Which is the capital of India. It's in North India where I studied and was accused of being a witch. He talks about benevolent jinns because there are particular mosques or Muslim shrines that are said to be inhabited by jinns. And if you go there on particular days at particular times, and if you wish for something, the jinns will grant you that wish. But they can also be kind of harmful. So there's a very famous British Indian author called Ruskin Bond, who was my favorite author growing up. He has this very popular story about jinns, where he says, so jinns really like women with long hair. They're really attracted to long hair.
Who doesn't?
So I have really long hair. I think all of us have really long hair. And I was always told to not leave my hair open. When I'm going out, it had to be in a plait or in a ponytail or in a bun or something. And one of the reasons for that is because people believe that if a jinn sees a woman with beautiful long hair that's open, he will reach out and sort of start stroking your hair. And the more he strokes your hair, the more of your lifeblood you lose. So in this story, what's left is this girl sort of starts to grow thinner and weaker. And then at the end, she dies and is reduced to a really, really thin state. And all that's left of her mortal body is the beautiful head of hair.
Is this why I'm so tired all the time?
Could be. Could
wow.
be.
Wow. We need to work on this.
Yeah. At least my hair will survive me. I mean, it is definitely my best feature. So
it's true. There is also I think it's the same story. Ruskin Bond writes a lot of really good supernatural stories. That's his forte. So if anyone's interested, please read his work. Ruskin Bond describes the djinn as actually being a friend of his who had an alternative existence as a djinn. So one of the things that happens is, so there's a road and the djinn is sitting on one side of the road on a park bench. And on the opposite side, there's a girl with really long hair and he sort of reaches, they can extend their arms to indefinite lengths. So he reaches out across the road to stroke her hair, but then a truck or something passes by and runs over his extended arm. And so he only had one arm. After that, and that's the story of how he got one arm.
Well, he better have learned his lesson. Yeah. Don't go stroking women's hair without permission.
I know. Don't touch me. That's weird.
I think it's really cool. In my background, our hair is our life force as well, and we only let certain people touch our hair. Like only certain people can braid our hair. And in the past, even when someone wronged you or did something wrong, they would actually cut off a lock of their hair and offer it to you, and it would be seen as like they're offering you a part of their life force or a part, like a year of their life or what have you. It was like in grave instances, but it was it's interesting to me how ideas of like life force manifesting from hair.
It's also interesting how in a lot of cultures apology comes in the form of giving up a part of yourself, it like a physical part of yourself, like a hair, or, you know, something that is symbolically a part of you and your heritage. I think that's really interesting.
And also, like, I feel like in a lot of the major shows, if you're showing absolute rock bottom or, like, a horrible time in a character's life. Yeah, in, like, Cersei and in Game of Thrones, when her hair gets, like, shaved and cut off, or, I don't know, I feel like it's also a sign of like complete transformation and change. Not always good, but sometimes good. It just depends.
It's like that scene in Fleabag where she's like, "Hair is everything."
I need to watch Fleabag again.
I've not seen that yet.
I wish we could discuss Bulbul because I think it's a fabulous film.
Yeah.
And it's just, everyone watch it on Netflix. It's amazing.
Yeah.
We're not sponsored so good by the makers of Bulbul.
No, we're not. It's so beautiful though. It's so well done. And the beauty of just the colors and the scenery and the cinematography is, and then the storyline is so good. And
the actress who plays Bulbul is really ravishing.
She's stunning. Like, if I was a djinn, I'd be wanting that hair.
She was beautiful. So, yeah, everyone watch that film.
Yeah, I'm personally curious. You said your grandma and your mom told you a lot of stories like every night before bed.
Yeah.
Is there some like one story in particular that stands out to you or something that you believe in more than the others or anything like that?
Okay, there's this one story. This was, I can't remember whether it was my mom or my dad who said, my dad was not a very bedtime storyteller kind of a figure because I'd be asleep most days by the time he got home. But he had this one sort of patent story that would always give me goosebumps.
Ooh.
Okay, so the story is that there's this guy, it's a group of friends, college kids. And so now too, but back in the day, men used to wear dhotis or lungis, which is basically the male equivalent of a sari. It's basically a long piece of cloth that's wrapped around your waist and covers your legs, your ankles, everything, right? So, and that's important to this story. So, it's a group of friends and they sort of are talking about who's the bravest, the sort of daring each other to do different things. And this one guy claims that, you know, I'm the bravest, I can do anything. And then his friends kind of get annoyed and say that, okay, there's this particular, it's sort of like an open tract of land with a huge banyan tree in the middle. We want you to take a nail, right? Like the kinds you hammer in. Take a nail and a hammer, take it into the field and nail it into the ground right under the tree on a moonless night, right? And then next day we're going to go and check it. And if it's there, you're the bravest.
This already sounds like a bad idea. And I don't even know what this means. It just sounds bad. Like,
but then he's a man and he's going to do it.
Of course he is. This is how men die.
Mm-hmm. What he does is he takes a hammer and a nail and he goes into the tree on a moonless night, and he starts hammering the nail into the ground. But when he's about to get up, he realizes that he's nailed his dhoti, like a part of his dhoti along with the nail into the ground. So he's sort of trying to remove it. So he's busy trying to remove it. And then he feels something like a liquid or something drop onto his hand, and he thinks it's sort of water or something. So he sort of brushes it off, but then a couple of more drops fall on his hand and he smells it and he realizes it's blood, right? So he looks up and he can see a hand sort of hanging from the tree, right? He loses his shit. He starts running. The dhoti is ripped from the bottom and he just keeps running until he gets to sort of an old, in Bengal we have a lot of these old roadside tea stores. They're like shacks, they're pretty run down, but they have the best tea and they have the best homemade biscuits. But that's not the case in this story. So basically he goes into this little shop and he asks for water because he's panting, and then it's a sleepy little shop and there it's just the owner that's there, and the owner comes out like, yeah, have some water. And then he's like, what happened? Why do you look out of breath? So then this boy, he says, I was running. I'd gone to, you know, my friends had bet me to do this, hammer a nail into the ground under the tree. And I was there and I saw this bloody hand just hanging from the tree branch. And the man said, oh. And then he removes his shawl and says, is it this hand? And that's the end of the story.
Ew.
That's okay. That's giving, what are they called?
Urban legend?
Yeah. Like, it sounds like an urban legend.
Yeah.
This is an urban legend. It could be for all the... I mean, Calcutta, the city where I was brought up, which is also the capital of West Bengal, it has a very spooky history. I mean, there are lots of stories about hauntings, about especially a lot of the colonial buildings. So there's this huge plot of land called the Maidan in Calcutta, which is basically just a huge plot of grass. And people play cricket and they just, you know, people come on Sundays for picnics. Mm-hmm. And their horse carriage is sort of going around and you can have a little tour of the city. Not the city, the area around. But it's hella spooky at night. Mm-hmm. On a winter night, I would not go to the Maidan. So I don't know if it's sort of a legend created around the Maidan.
I mean, there's something definitely unsettling about seeing like open expanses of land at night. It's just, especially when everything's so still and you're just like, this doesn't feel right. I'm leaving.
There are also a lot of, not stories, but sort of warnings that because there are lots of horse carriages around the Maidan, people say you shouldn't get into one post midnight, especially if you're alone. Because there's always going to be someone else in the carriage with you.
Ooh.
I like that
one. Like, don't get in a taxi after midnight.
Yeah.
Okay, one last thing. I have to ask you about this. Can we discuss the Wicca phenomenon that happened in India, please?
Okay. So this is not... I wouldn't call it a movement or a phenomenon, but I'm not going to take names. In Bengal, there is a Wicca, Wicca has taken root in Bengal over the past couple of decades. and it's become a thing. And a lot of I accidentally went to a Wicca meeting once because they said it was advertised as a book discussion, and it was for the major part a book discussion, but it slowly changed into something else. And I realized that everyone there was Wiccan or sort of interested in Wicca. And everyone there was like the who's who of Calcutta.
I know, you said that that's major wild. Woman who's Wicca yeah, was yeah, there. Yeah. I just thought it was so interesting. Like the thing I gravitated towards was when I hear Wicca, I think of like UK, sometimes US, but like yeah. mostly UK, like movements in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and how, you know, in the 90s everyone was like, I'm Wiccan, like yeah. as a, I don't know, as like a societal rebellion thing. But it was so interesting to me that it's taken root in India.
It is slightly rebellious in the sense the woman who started the sort of movement, she studied Wicca for a long time before publicly coming out as a witch. And I think this was the 80s, and a lot of people in Bengal, a lot of women in rural Bengal were being accused of being witches and were hunted down and were murdered for similar reasons that they were murdered in Assam, right? A lot of it was property disputes, or the woman was not traditionally homely, among other reasons. And this woman, she did a lot of work to sort of fight the tag of witchcraft and black magic in rural Bengal. I think she's helped a lot of women reclaim their lives and just generally spread a lot of interest in non-mainstream spiritual practices and medicinal practices. So I think that's kind of cool.
The problem is though that she's from an upper caste, right?
Yeah. So she does come from a very I mean, from her name, I can infer that she's from an upper caste and an upper class family. She was born into a very privileged family. And one of the sort of problems that I think, as an anthropologist, as a well-meaning social scientist, is that a lot of the women who are accused of being witches don't have the sort of resources sort of secure in terms of security to resort to if the going gets bad, right? So it's for a lot of them, I mean, if someone is from a very influential family and if they do come out as witches, chances are the backlash they face is going to be next to negligible versus someone who is found out, within quotes, to be a witch, who lives in rural India, who has no property to their name, has no bank account, has no familial support, right? And I mean, and I say that knowing that this woman, I mean, even she faced a lot of backlash from the then government and the then news media for calling herself a witch. But compared to what a lot of these rural women face, it's so lightweight. Mm-hmm. So that's there. And I think, you know, accusations of witchcraft and witchery and black magic, they sort of go very hand in hand with the kind of caste and class dynamics we have in India. And I think it's important to be sensitive to that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a really good article, and I'm not like Shitoma, so I cannot remember the names of authors nor the titles, but it basically talks about how the deviance of black magic is literally tied up in racial and ethnic disparity in a lot of places.
That makes sense.
And it's really well written. I will link it once I find it. But
I know we have that kind of thing here in the US where we talk about like voodoo in like Louisiana and places like that, where a huge percentage of the population,
New Orleans, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. like a huge percent of the population there is black and descendant from slaves, and you know, there's a lot of like a lot of times you'll see in fiction, you know, somebody going to like a voodoo priestess or something like that. And it's like very like spooky and supernatural and ominous, like, right? Whereas like, I feel like you don't see that with, you know, fiction with a lot of like white ladies practicing magic of some sort. It's just, I don't know.
Voodoo is like so, so vilified.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting too, because it actually incorporates so much of Catholicism in its practices.
It does, yeah.
So it's interesting how a slightly Christianified practice has been entirely like portrayed as like this demonic black magic that people are doing to try to strike people down. And yeah, we should do an episode on Vodun.
That'd be a really cool one.
Even in Hindu and Islamic religious practices, if you look at a lot of colonial literature, a lot of them call these practices demonic, monstrous. You know, they call Hindu deities demonic. Why do they have four arms, for example? Anything that's not sort of Christian is weird.
Anything that's not a white guy with a beard is not Christian, which is so funny considering it wasn't even white.
For sure. You know, here in the U.S., we get the little picture of Jesus in everybody's church where he's very clearly a white guy with like pretty brown hair, and he's like looking angelically up at the sky with like blue eyes. Like I can just see this picture in my head so clearly.
That's also Jesus in India, by the way. In every church that I've been to in India, that's Jesus.
That's wild.
Wow, Jesus. But yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, one of the things I've been curious about is when sort of deities and their images travel across cultures and communities, they're often adapted to resemble, to sort of resemble a particular kind of cultural aesthetic. So the clothes they wear, the shape of their bodies, the way they wear their hair, for instance, is also sort of changed. And I don't see that sort of change in the way Jesus is represented in India.
Yeah.
I honestly think, I mean, it's everywhere. He's like that image everywhere. I think it kind of goes to show the difference between when people willingly choose to merge you know, their own beliefs with whatever is introduced to them versus when it's forced on you and becomes a literal like propaganda machine that you continue.
I think it's, you know, one of those things where it's like, if a religion spreads naturally, you know, with like immigration and, you know, movements of people and things like that, or then that's when it's going to get really incorporated into a local culture. But when it's spread by like, quote, missionaries, that's when it's going to be, it's going to look the same, right? Because the people who are bringing it are literally bringing that image with them and saying, here is what's right.
Yeah. Although, I mean, now a lot of people now convert to Christianity willingly for a lot of reasons, especially a lot of lower caste Hindus, right? So in Hindus, we have the horrible caste system with Brahmins at the top oppressing everyone and Dalits at the bottom being oppressed for centuries. And a lot of Dalit people, they have been converting for a couple of decades to Christianity, to Buddhism, to Islam, to sort of escape the oppressive sort of tendency in a huge chunk of Hinduism, right? But I still don't see, I don't know, maybe it takes more time, maybe it'll take another century or two before Jesus starts looking and dressing more Indian than a really ripped white guy.
A white chocolate bar.
All right. So I suppose we will go ahead and sign off.
Yeah, so as per usual, guys, you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'd be especially happy if you gave us a 5-star rating on Spotify and a nice review on Apple Podcasts.
We have all the social medias. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Patreon. On all of those, we are Wicked, Weird, and Grim. And on Twitter, we are Wicked, Weird, Grim. and join our exclusive Facebook group for behind the scenes looks and updates and a ton of memes being shared thanks to Ara.
All the memes. Oh, yeah. I think I'm the only person that posts on that group.
Yeah, I don't even think I've ever logged in to post there ever.
Yeah, you can check out our website courtesy of Wix at wickedweirdandgrim.wixsite.com, and also check out our Redbubble for our Wicked Weird and Grim collection for fair price merch, searching our username Wicked Weird Grim.
And as always, thanks for listening, and thanks so much for coming on, Tritoma. We had so much fun.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Well, yeah, it was so fun. I feel like I learned a lot, but also
I learned so much.
Yeah, now I'm also a little bit scared of walking under trees, if I'm honest. If I feel any pressure, I'm just gonna be no, and just melt just, into a puddle.
Just carry an umbrella at all times.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah. Wait, just so they won't.
I don't know.
You're supposed to know.
Try it.
She's like, yeah, so they're going to jump on you, but I don't have a solution for that. So, okay, guys, we will catch you next Wicked Weird Wednesday with the Grimm Sisters. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Me and Tritoma both waved.
Yeah, you guys are wavers.
Yeah, I always wave.